Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which takes the form of a 327 subsection 9 appendix 3 conversation. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm a tatty old pool cleaner for this one.
And we are going to visit the great pool in the sky. It's Paradise Towers.
Here we are. I managed to watch it. It was one of those ones we broke out of the cellophane.
It's actually pretty good. I think this is one where there are some production problems that kind of get in the way of the sort of full realization of what's going on. But the script and by extension the novelization are actually both incredibly clever.
It's League of Gentlemen light, isn't it? Before League of Gentlemen.
Yeah, I guess so. It does have that sort of weird, dark, gothic thing going on.
And all local.
It's very, very local. And in fact, it is a Doctor Who story set in a lot of space corridors, which I've complained about sort of quite a lot. I think we'll get it again at the end of the season. It's a lot of space corridors, but it manages to do something different from what we've had for a while. And we've observed before, I think it's fairly well known that this is the first Doctor Who story for a very, very long time that hasn't had any returning elements, that doesn't really reference anything that's happened before, that can just be understood on its own terms.
Sorry, corridors don't count.
No, that's right.
This is actually the first claustrophobic use of the real sense of isolation in corridors. And again, as we went on and on and on and on and on and on last episode, thanks for listening, that the sense of the now is very much at the front of this. This is a tower block, and this is about, we're going to see this in Rose, aren't we?
Yeah, it's
but touched on much more kindly. Yeah.
And it's a decaying tower block with all of these promises, with a glossy brochure, with, you know, promises of an exciting future and happiness and achievement, and it's all gone to hell and it's inhabited by warring tribes.
Do you think this was J&T having a go back at Jonathan Powell and maybe Doctor Who Bulletin?
You know, I think that J&T is one of the least political producers that we've ever had.
Apolitical.
Yeah, and given that combination with Eric Saywood, who was also not interested in doing politics, just meant that we had a Doctor Who that supported the status quo and really didn't engage with the outside world. And this story, I think, is a type of story that Doctor Who has done before, and I think we were thinking about the Macra Terror fairly recently, where it's not set on the planet Blizzbloz. We don't know what planet it's on. It's not set on a planet. It's not set on a spaceship or a space station. It's set in a big building, and that building, we're given no idea where it is, really how it got here. And there is a sort of backstory that doesn't really work and doesn't add up, and I think it's partly because the ages of all of the people who are cast are sort of all wrong. So it doesn't add up with what we're told about the backstory. But that just doesn't matter because
it really
it's openly allegorical. And the idea is that we're illustrating something about society by having an artificial and an openly artificial situation created where no one has kind of normal names, you know, people have titles and stuff or they're called Fire Escape or Bin Liner or whatever. And so it's really just saying something about contemporary society. Stephen Wyatt, who wrote this, will do a similar thing with The Greatest Show in the Galaxy. And I think Russell T. Davies will really bring this approach to its apotheosis in Gridlock.
Have a drink.
And Gridlock, again, is openly unrealistic. I still have friends who complain.
You loved it, didn't you?
I think it's superb. Yeah. And you know, I have friends who complain, no one's going to drive in a car for 20 years. And you kind of think, no.
What are you doing now? I would say that, again, this one might have slipped under the radar. I actually think it's got to do with things like lighting and not to do with casting at all or set, although there are some questions there, and maybe Nicholas Mallet after Mysterious Planet, although he said he actually ran away from and quit on a job, which directors should never do, but he quit on a job doing a German miniseries filmed in Berlin, written by Pip and Jane Baker, to come back and do this. Go on. How do you feel this fits in? I think it's directly after Time in the Rani. It is really getting straight into the critique of modern life in a very dark and upfront way that kids can recognise and that older people can recognise. And it's very much the Judge Dredd 2000 AD universe.
Yeah, which is, again, what he's doing in Gridlock. Mm. And so what you have here is, on a surface level, is a sort of critique of modernism in the sense of a building is a machine rather than... A machine for living rather than... something for human beings. The architect creates the building but doesn't want people to spoil it by living in it.
Do you know who said that? Le Corbusier, Pierre Genet. Do you know what else he said that's not even in the architecture textbooks? You've actually got to go in and read his stuff, which I had to do at school. He was one of the progenitors, along with the Bauhaus school that then went into Europe, you know, and that's actually the reason we have this style of building is in fact the Nazi Party. It is in fact the excising of the Jewish population of Europe that these architects came to America and came to the UK. But Le Corb was very famous for saying the whole design of tower blocks is to get people off the streets and to quell nascent Marxism. Right. The principle and the reason he got early government funding is that if you isolate people onto floors with doors that don't face each other, with nowhere to gather, with no marketplace, they won't be able to have political inclusion.
Yeah, they won't be able to organise. And so this is a story of...
utterly deliberate.
Yeah, well, it's a story of a society that's fragmented into tribes that are all preying on one another and that are all hostile to one another. And
J.G. Ballard.
Exactly, yeah. And that's the other thing, High Rise, which I won't pretend to have read.
I did back in the day. It's okay. It's just this story. Mm. I liked Empire of the Sun, which is the reason he was getting nodded to, and that was a film around this time that Spielberg, and that's when Ballard was a fruitcake. He was like a Samuel R. Delaney, really wacko, was doing a whole lot of fun stuff, not just mushroom rissoles, to really – it's good. It's worth reading if you like this story. I suggest we should all be looking at the things that were going on around this era, yeah, because it's very rich.
And so very simply, the story is that those people learn to work together and organise against a murderous authority figure, you know, someone who has created this society, given it the shape that it has, and then sets about massacring everyone, and the people all join together and defeat their oppressors with the Doctor's encouragement. And I think it's classic, it's terrific, it's in the tradition of the Sun Makers, where the Doctor arrives and an oppressive society is overthrown within a day. And it's, you know, spectacularly angry and fabulous. And it's not without its flaws, but I think it's really terrific.
Yeah, it's funny for me because I grew up in Campbelltown, which has a lot of public housing, social housing. It's not in the form of tower blocks out there. It's in the form of these whole cul-de-sacs full of
little townhouses.
Full of little townhouses.
Ramsey Street.
Yeah. but when I went to school, I was from a different area from this. It still had some public housing, but it was mostly private housing.
Yeah.
And there were people who looked down on the people living in the social housing. And even around Ayres, where I went to school, it was roughly, I would say, 70% social housing and 30% private housing. But if you said you came from there, it was assumed you lived in social housing and therefore your family was poor and this, that, the other. Now, for us as kids, most of us didn't buy into that. It was parents. It was people on the Parents and Citizens Committee who were overruling people on the Parents and Citizens Committee who lived in these houses because, oh, no, you shouldn't have a say in the uniforms. You shouldn't have a say in what the school spends money on.
Interesting, and, you know, isn't it?
I only found out in the years afterwards. And also, I did find out while I was there because one of my best friends lived in a privately owned house in this area and his family were really looked down on. And yeah, no one deserves to be really looked down on for that reason, but it's that kind of thing. You've got the caretakers looking down on everyone. You've got the resis looking down on the Kangs. And you've got the Kangs, who know that the caretakers and the Rezis are corrupt, but no one will believe them. And again, it's pitting everyone against each other within this environment so they don't notice the evil that's living underneath them.
Much like modern media.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very much so. And again, critical theory had already assumed that that's the base of writing up until this period, this mid-80s period, that people were consuming pap. Warhol said it when he famously said, if we just feed a tube from their from their fundaments, just dye it pink, put flavouring in it and put it in your mouth, and that's modern culture.
Mm. And I think also the queer message continues through this story as well, because, the Kangs are all girls. You don't see any young men of their age except for pecs. And I think
really count.
No. Plus, I think, you were talking about the chronology of this story, Nathan. It's like, this story might work if pecs was in his 30s and the Kangs were in their very early 20s to late teens, and the war started 15 years ago. So, pecs could have gone because he was 16, but the Kangs couldn't go because they were two or three. Because, you don't see any women in their 30s. So presumably the women who were of fighting age went off to fight the war as well.
Yeah. No, I mean, it doesn't make work. Sense. And it's the thinnest possible sort of premise. And once you start casting, that pretty young caretaker in episode one who gets killed, like, why wasn't he off at the war? I mean, it doesn't work, really.
Exactly.
But it's not meant to.
No. And, I think Tilda and Tabby are very clearly coded as queer. They're two old ladies living together.
And Nathan will like them because they're cannibals.
And Tilda's clearly the feeder. Because I am not saying that in terms of, Tabby's bigger. I'm saying that in terms of we only see Tabby eating. Like, when there's the scene with the rat, Tilda actually makes this little snide comment that she didn't have much to eat of it because Tabby had the rest. But,
I think she's just trying to preserve her own safety. It's so clever.
Yeah. And I think also they're a little bit of a pastiche of the Golden Girls. The Golden Girls were popular at this time.
They're certainly wearing a lot of nylon, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think they're, as much a pastiche of Coronation Street.
That cannibalism cliffhanger, the cliffhanger at the end of episode two, must be actually one of my favourite cliffhangers ever, where Mel's being threatened by a toasting fork and she's got like a crocheted knee rug over her face and she's screaming and things. And it's also beautifully set up.
Yeah. Richard, couldn't you imagine that happening to Tara King? I mean, really, that's an Avengers moment. That actually, you can imagine that happening in Homicide and Old Lace, the Avengers episode that was cobbled together out of a failed Tara King pilot. And there's Mother telling the story of Steed and Tara to his two old aunts who greet him with handguns and then say, oh no, they're presents, we're not about to shoot you. Really.
Because it is in itself a pastiche and homage to those old Hollywood horrors.
It's funny and it's well set up too.
But it's also touching on the fact that there were pensioners freezing in the 80s and starving literally because of Thatcher's cuts.
Yeah. And now Mr. Cameron and Miss May.
Yeah.
So I do think, however, there are production problems. I think
The lighting's a hell of a lot better.
Those beautiful bits with silver illuminated from behind. Yeah. They've turned the lights down.
Mallet got that. Yeah. He said he wanted to redress the mistakes, the really obvious mistakes he'd made. It doesn't get all the way to the casting, though, does it?
You're talking about the production. Well, I think the music is terrible.
Oh, thank you.
And
we're back to my Bette Noir, my Black Betty, which is Kevin McCulloch. Have you heard the David Snell score?
Yeah, I don't like that very much.
Don't you? I think it's a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, I do think it is better, but it is a bit atonal. It's kind of like he's heard Dudley Simpson and that's the last Doctor Who score that he's heard.
As there should be.
Well, it isn't very good, but it is sort of striving to be sort of atmospheric. So I think the music's a problem. I think some of the performances, I mean, they're doing sort of broad kids TV and maybe that works given the sort of hyper-reality of kind of the premise. I don't know. And I do think that Richard Briers is terrible.
What do you think, Brendan?
No, I agree. Richard Briers is terrible. And if you watch Not in general, just in this.
I really want to disagree, but no, he's one of them.
Yeah, like, you know, everything else. I love him. Everything else I've ever seen him in, especially The Good Life, of course, Monarch of the Glen. He's brilliant. He is a great actor. But when you watch the making of on DVD, you find out why he's terrible in this, and it's because he treated it like a joke.
Yeah, he did. He was playing the very last big sitcom he'd done in the, I'm just trying to remember what it was called, Ever Decreasing Circles was the show he'd just done. He played it exactly the same way.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem is he says in his interview on the DVD that the chief caretaker is a little Hitler. And I just remember seeing on Twitter at some point, and again, I apologize, I didn't save the tweet, so I can't remember who it was, but someone I follow on Twitter who is Jewish just came out with, Richard Briers, how dare you? The caretaker is not Hitler. You know, Hitler was a monster. The caretaker is a bureaucrat. Hitler wasn't a bureaucrat.
Yeah, no, it's stupid. And then
it's dumbed
down. His decision to play it like whatever the hell he thinks he's doing in episode 4 once he's got the great architect's brain in his head. I mean, he's clearly striving for someone who's just suffered brain surgery at the hands of a garbage compactor. But it's... It's a terrible, terrible ill-judged performance, and it's sort of horribly ableist in this sort of really unpleasant way.
There's no menace in it whatsoever.
No.
And, you know, there's very little menace in Crowagnon up to that point because he's just a pair of neon lights with a monster voice.
You see, I actually...
A pair of Mozzie zappers, yeah.
I actually really like that. I think that's super funny. And I do think that Richard Briers calling him my pet, you know, in this sort of desperate attempt to enforce some sort of hierarchy where he's the owner and Croagnon's the pet, but all the snivelling and cowering that he does shows that it's quite the other way around.
See, that's the one set of scenes where I like Richard Briers. I think he gets it right there. And I think then... The main problem with his chief caretaker portrayal is that the chief caretaker is always on the brink of losing control. And so when he does lose control in front of Croagnon, there's no surprise. But if he'd played it sort of, oh no, everything's fine and I'm completely straight down the line, like if he like played it like a stereotypical detective sergeant on the bill and then falls to pieces in front of Croagnon, that's scary.
And nuanced it and led up to it. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But I think the point is that he's a sort of pathetic Jobsworth. Do you know what I mean?
He might have just seen recent Doctor Who.
Yeah, he could have said, oh, JNT, can you send me some tapes of Doctor Who? JNT sends him Time Lash. Oh, that's how I'm meant to play it. But then you've got Clive Merrison.
who's great.
But the thing is, he plays the deputy chief caretaker as someone who's competent.
And also with a proper fanboy Trainspotting accent. Can I just mention, can we name check Clive Merrison for a moment? I'm so glad we remembered. He's my favourite Sherlock Holmes.
Oh.
Up to and almost including Jeremy Brett. So Jeremy Brett from the classic 80s.
Yeah.
You know who was actually tipped to play the chief caretaker, don't you? Edward Hardwick, who was
one of the Watsons.
Who was a good Watson, yes. But I think Clive Merrison is – I just love him. Do listen – if you haven't heard the BBC for – they've got Mr. Judy Dench, Michael Williams, playing Watson. He is actually the best Watson of all time. He really is extraordinary with Merrison. They're my favourite audio, no offence to Nick Briggs, favourite audio Sherlock Holmes. Have you heard them?
No, I have heard
all of
them.
They're so good. They're so good.
I mean, of course, he was in –
And they're just camp enough. Yes, speaking of, camping off. I think he's quite rat-rich on TV, but he really in everything. But he's superb on radio. So he's chief caretaker. I think he's taking the mickey as well.
Yeah. But he's doing the children's TV performance that everyone's doing, I think.
Mind you, I really like the moment where he says, the one situation where you're allowed to disobey the rules is when the chief caretaker is just not the chief caretaker. I think... He is playing it for kids' TV, but he plays that realization quite well. He then has to do that completely stupid jump over, can we talk about the cleaners?
Yeah, they're really bad.
I so wanted to love them as much as the war machines, and I didn't.
I think a big problem is... is the long lingering shots of them going down corridors. Junk. It is hilarious seeing mannequin legs with fluffy slippers sticking out of them, don't get me wrong. But I think the problem is you get a long lingering 30-second shot of them, which Kev McCulloch then has to fill with music.
With his score. All of that just to get the nether regions of Thora Herd sticking out of the back. And haven't we all wished we'd been there at one point or another?
You know, I have to say, with the music for this, I do enjoy it, but I agree a lot of the times it is working against the drama. One piece I particularly love, though, is the Kang's greeting routine with the raising your arms up one at a time and lowering them. Because as a kid, I looked at that and I went, it's, I'm going to hit you. No, I'm not going to hit you. I'm not going to hit you. And now I greet you. They're in this culture where playful violence is how they fight with their other tribes, with the other Kangs.
And the only television they have is reruns of Eurovision, because it honestly all looks like dance moves from the Dutch ensemble.
That's true as well. But they're showing, I'm not going to hit you with my left hand, I'm not going to hit you with my right hand, and now I'm going to greet you. Yeah, I kind of get what they're going for.
Yeah, yeah, no, like it's subtle and clever.
Yeah, you know, I get their language, which in a way it has to be clunky so you pick up what they're trying to say, like ice hot is cool, high fashion, high fashion.
These are picking up on Marshall McLuhan terms, you know. So again, we're indulging in meta critiques of media. And he's the one who coined the terms hot and cool. I won't go into it again, dear listener, unless you ask, in which case I really will. But they're actually picking. That's what I mean about this thing working on so many different levels. Yeah. This is kind of sad that it doesn't quite get there. But if you look at the etchiness and scratchiness of graphics at the time and really of the quality of media, I think the fact that it allows, as you were saying before, Nathan, about Time and the Rani, which didn't really do this. It talked about glossy, and glossy itself was a subversion of the gritty reality of what these people were going through, whereas here the grit is on the surface and brought home. I think it still works as a critique for, you know, a double whammy of what the story is trying to do.
Yeah.
I don't think the appearance or the look or the styling or even the casting is actually working against the narrative.
Mm. Big Finish have kind of done a remake of this story. It's called Spaceport Fear.
Oh, I just heard that.
With Colin and Bonnie. Yes. And the premise is that there's this group of people who've been locked in a like an airport lounge, but for spaceships. Right. For a few generations. And so you get the corruptions of language, like when people talk about being children, they say, oh, no, that's been there since I was carry-on.
Right.
But I think listening to Spaceport Fear, it's because it's more polished, it's not as successful for me. But also I look back on this with the nostalgia of a six-year-old watching.
Mm.
And one thing I particularly love, I picked up on this when we were live tweeting it a few weeks ago, is I find it hard to imagine Colin Baker in this story because the Doctor with the Kangs, he doesn't correct their language. He doesn't diminish their culture.
Isn't that a joyous relief?
He joins in.
Yes.
Sylvester McCoy as the Doctor is a working class Doctor. And we'll see
an osmotic influence in that, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll see this all the way through his tenure. He'll buddy up with the guards who are working the door. He'll buddy up with the Kangs. And, you know, he tries to adopt their language as well to communicate with them. And they really like him as a result. And in the first scene when they meet Mel, Mel does hang back and, you know, I don't want to be a Kang. Well, we don't want you to be a Kang. They like the Doctor because even though he's an oldster, he speaks to them on their level, whereas Mel retains her middle-class poshness. And again, there's that classism going on.
Lower middle class.
lower middle class poshness. The upper hand.
It's all shoulder pads and knee warmers.
Oh, actually, we barely talked about her outfit last week, but she's got another cracking outfit this week.
I know, she says, I'm not really one of any colour. No, you're all of them, you're melange.
She's wearing blue. Why do the red
orange hair? Oh, I don't know what I am, no.
Yeah, actually, you're right. Maybe that's why they're asking, because she's got red hair, but she's got the blue outfit. I'd never thought of that.
Absolutely no dress sense. She is really the carry-on from the Colin era, and you do need that. You do need to recognise the immediate past in that I don't really think she fits in. For me, Bonnie plays this exactly the same pitch and relativism that Katie Manning played her part in, that she plays it for the junior audience, whether that was direction or whether that was Bonnie's feeling for it or whether it's just that the way she read the lines and thought, what else are you going to do with this? But also maybe that's where Bonnie's career was at the time too. She was a Pando star and a singing dancing girl, so she was brought in for the lightness of touch.
I think,
but it doesn't work for me at all.
No? Well, I think next week when she's on location, her performance is quite different.
She gets a bit of mud on her.
Well, it's a little bit more realistic because she's shooting it in a realistic environment, whereas this does still feel like a stage and everyone else is going panto in this one. So I
they
think,
are really,
yeah.
Aren't they?
I kind of like that she gets a pseudo romance with Pex, and it's not really a romance because we're not doing romance in this part. Yeah, you know, it's all very broad strokes.
And Pex is gay.
And
obviously.
Pex is gay.
I'm glad you mentioned broad strokes because it is more of a strap on, right? isn't
it? But first of all, there's that great bit where he pulls the lighting fixture off the wall to impress her, and her immediate reaction is just, you're destroying something for no purpose exactly. whatsoever. If you could put that back there and it could serve some purpose, that'd be great. But you can't create, you can only destroy. And I'm like, but that is a great statement of what Doctor Who should be about.
Yes, and what it hasn't been recently.
Yeah. No, it's like Patrick Troughton and all the crockery in that caravan in The Enemy of the World.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
People it's make people lovely things. People spend all their time making putting lovely podcasts together, and then other people come along just to destroy them.
But yeah, they get.
I mean, listen, we're looking at you.
Despite the fact that they do spend like half of episode 3 trapped in a cupboard that just happens to be a lift, they get some really lovely moments where, like where Mel discovers that Pex has been lying all this time and he's actually a deserter. And she is just, she's really quite not upset with him, but just really sad that he's had to lie to her. And
he wasn't able to own himself. That nicely shadows what we just saw last night, doesn't it? We just saw Empress of Mars on TV last night, and that really lovely, subtle performance.
Yeah. From another deserter.
From another red-coated hottie, yes.
In fact, I think Pex is obviously pivotal here, and the very last shot has the words Pex lives and two sort of Kang colours scrawled on the wall. And I think that Pex is, and I live tweeted this and got a little bit of pushback, but I'm going with it. I think that his storyline is heavily informed by the story of Jesus. And I think, seriously, I think that he is an outcast. He's despised and rejected of men. Everyone hates and mocks him. He, however, sacrifices his life, lays down his life so that a group of people who are fragmented and at odds and in terrible danger unite together. The very last thing that we see is them having a religious ceremony to honour him. And then, of course, his ultimate resurrection with the words Pex lives at the end. Mm. They're animated by that spirit of self-sacrifice that he exhibits. I love the scene where he loses his bottle. He's got to delay the great architect from getting there so they have time to get their plans in place. And he's stepped up and he's been so brave and everyone's so proud of him and he knows what's hanging on this, but he still just can't bring himself to be brave enough to do the right thing. He has to step in and sacrifice himself instead. And I think that's so lovely for something where all the characters are types, where none of them have proper names, where there's a level of unreality. There is a little bit of a level of realism there, which I just think
you're
is
saying
lovely.
That C.S. Lewis could have written this.
No, he's horrible.
That's what he would have done.
In no way Marxist at all.
And then it makes a Bonnie Mary Magdalene. And if it makes Sylvester the Holy Ghost.
See, what I love about that scene is, you know, Pex tries to run away from the fight as the Doctor is having his head caved in. And what makes him come back isn't just Mel looking at him, it's him looking at his Kang bracelet and realizing he finally belongs and he's finally accepted for who he is. And that's when he lays down his life.
Do you think that's what they're trying to tell us, that Jesus was actually just a member of one of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story gangs, really?
It was all just Jesus, really, you know, his,
which makes Leonard, which makes God entirely Old Testament Jewish and queer, if he is in fact Leonard Bernstein.
Well, we've just said Pex is gay.
It's all making a lot more sense to me.
When I say broad strokes earlier, it's a story that functions on, as you say, archetypes.
Yeah.
You know, the three old ladies who are named are Tilda, Tabby, and Maddie. They're all sort of
cats.
Oh, yeah,
Sutek, good point. She's behind Brendan right now.
Then you've got the Kangs, who are all named after architectural features, like bin liner, fire escape, drinking fountain.
Yeah. And yet this really is abominable. It just doesn't work. It doesn't hold together. I know we're all so nice about this, about everything, but it doesn't, does it? I mean, there's great little moments, but it doesn't hold together.
Gareth Roberts once said that if season 24 had tone meetings, the way that the new series does, and everyone was on the same page with Tone. Yeah. And if it was put on Saturday night with the same level of advertisement of Trial of the Time Lord, he says it would have got double the ratings. He's like, there's nothing wrong with the script. Yep. There's nothing wrong with the direction. Script there's nothing wrong with the performance. They're just all pulling in different directions.
Getting Wyatt was a real coup. And we have to say, J&T had him on board before Cartmell had come along because of the play clause, which also had, I think, Elizabeth Spriggs in it, didn't it? It was a send-up of Cats and it was two old ladies. It was actually kind of like Vicious but without Ian McKellen or whoever the other old lovey was. I always say Patrick Stewart, but it's actually Derek Jacobi. You never see them in the same room together.
I have some sympathy for people who complain that it doesn't quite work. And I do think that season 24 does take a while to kind of hit its stride. And I do think there's one story in it that isn't particularly successful, but I don't think it's this one.
Yeah, for me, this is the one that isn't particularly successful, but we'll go on to more.
I think it's got enough going on that it overcomes the flaws in the production, which are undoubtedly present.
And there's joyfulness and you can see there's a willing intent to do a lot, not just to do good, but to make it messy and interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And it is messy. It is experimental. It's not clean and tidy.
We haven't seen it before, have we?
No, and it doesn't fit into the Hooniverse either. Do you know what I mean? There's no references to the tin clavic mines of Raga or anything
that disappoint you at all?
No. It didn't need a pterolepdal in it. It's functioning quite well without that. And
it had no monsters. It was actually Cartmell's thing to push the cleaners to make them the robot monster to appease.
That's surprising, considering J&T is so determined to have a marketable monster.
Didn't have a monster.
Yeah.
And that stupid crab thing in the which I actually think is terribly cute. The Toyota designed crab that's living in the terrible pool.
That's really cute. It's like Koreans being given Thunderbirds to remake. The Tamagotchi to you.
Did you know there's actually Paradise Towers apartments on the Gold Coast?
Stop it. Equally horrendous to anyone who'd care to look it up.
And as mentioned earlier, of course, Maddie is played by Judy Cornwell, completing the third of three annual guest appearances by a Keeping Up Appearances main actor.
God, it's true.
Yeah, she's Daisy. We had Onslow last year and we had Richard the year before. So
we have Cyril Cusack's daughter or granddaughter as one of the Kangs, the leader of the Blue Kangs.
Right. Of course.
And, of course, he was up for the casting alongside Billy.
Yes. And
Dame Cyril Cusack.
So, that's Catherine Cusack. And also as Fire Escape, we have Julie Brennan.
Yeah, Mrs.
Mrs. Mark Strickson at one point.
At the time, she was the one who said, "I was awful that they dyed his hair orange. Everyone looked at him. It was appalling. He was so self-conscious and he had a dreadful time." She would never shut up about it.
And then all of a sudden,
she was no longer Mrs. Strickson. Yes,
well, I was going to say all of a sudden she's put in red for this.
Funnier and crueler. I like it.
But oh, how I adore the scenes of Sylvester telling the Kangs about their history. I love them all sitting down to watch the video and drinking lemonade together.
Curiously refreshing. Yeah, they even take the piss out of Pepsi and Coke. It's really good.
Yeah, you know, I have to agree with you, Richard. It is a mess, but it's a mess that everyone wants to try to make good, except for Richard Briers. Everyone wants to try to make this entertaining TV. Everyone just has different ideas about how to achieve it.
It should be a mess because the context is messy. Does it work in the way that Horns of Nimon works?
When I watched it for the first time, I thought, "Oh, it's Graham Williams back." You know, there's this sort of
it does feel it, doesn't it? Yeah.
I actually think, in retrospect, it's not as witty as that. It's not as detached and ironic
as that. It's not sly in the way that
I think it is much more straightforward and a bit more earnest and political.
It's also young.
Yeah.
In the way that Williams stories never were.
Yeah. No. There was a kind of level of irony and things.
We were always being told what was funny by the older undergraduates in Williams' era. It was always, yes, Tom and Lola are students, but they're final years and they already know everything and they're terribly sophisticated. They probably smoke behind the toilet block. They're those sorts of kids. Whereas this lot, no, we're right here and now.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think it is much more serious, much more politically serious, and it really wants to do something that Doctor Who hasn't done for a long time, where Doctor Who has been deliberately trying to be apolitical and has only occasionally inadvertently stumbled into sort of horrific right-wing militaristic messages just out of sheer kind of incompetence. And so however flawed this is as a production, I just think it's really, really amazing. It's a great breath of fresh air. And if you, you know, don't aim high, do you know what I mean? You just produce the same Space Corridors every week.
But if you build high, you have a chance at happiness.
You do.
The thing is, I love that. And when I am in stressful situations and when I am unhappy, I get a voice in my head that says, build high for happiness. It's a lovely sentiment.
Look what you've done, Andrew Carnegie.
But going back to, you know, Doctor Who is now suddenly being political, I have to wonder if the cancellation slash hiatus is partially responsible for that, because I'm reading John Nathan Turner's biography by Richard Marson, Totally Tasteless, which was previously published as The Scandalous Life and Times of John Nathan Turner. And, of course, he was a producer of television in Thatcher's Britain, where, as we've discussed, gay either wasn't talked about or it was something to be looked down upon and shunned and shamed. I think John Nathan Turner's apoliticalism in producing Doctor Who was as much avoidance as it was self-preservation. I think he felt that he couldn't put political messages into the program.
Do you think he wanted to?
I don't know whether he wanted to, but I think by that point, having been at the BBC for so long, I think it had just become second nature to conceal. So when Andrew Cartmell comes along, first of all, he's got this political idea.
He's young, and he's Canadianese, yeah, he's straight.
But also, the show's already been cancelled. Yeah. Why not start kicking the hornet's nest when no one's watching anyway?
That's what I mean about Indian Summer, because this is just this brief respite, the resuscitation. Yeah.
That's like, right, where they have nothing to lose. No one's really watching, and so they can start to be crazy and experimental, and I think that's terrific. And there's something you said before on the podcast, Brendan, is, you know, you can't make art that's not political, you know, like –
That's a very profound statement. We go back to Walter Benjamin again, who I wanted to cite in a previous episode, Art and the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, when you say that all things are reduced and all things are pap and all things are repeated. But that doesn't necessarily devalue the message innate in each article, and the fact that it's mass-produced and the fact that it's everywhere doesn't make these lives any more dissolute or any more meaningless. In fact,
yeah, yeah. Well, I think that what ended up happening was that Doctor Who failed to engage with the outside world at all, and by default, that's a support of the status quo. The idea that, you know, the obsession of Doctor Who monster book reading teenagers is the most important thing that we want to address in this television program. Just kind of the subtext of that is because basically everything's okay and this is what we can afford to expend energy worrying about. And the deliberate rejection of that, there's nothing here that lovers of the Doctor Who monster book, there's no point at which you can go back to it to verify that a reference to the pteroleptils is correct. All that you've got instead is a political message about, you know, like a kind of Marxist political message in a sense. Mm. I mean, any society that you depict as inhabiting a building full of different floors, you know, you start to think about stratification and things.
That's what Benjamin touched on. And again, the integration of this and the mark with Marxism and with postmodernism is that you can take detritus but still find meaning because there are individual lives within this. This was all coming out of great despair. After the war, when we expected things to be fantastic and we expect, you know, that golden age, which is what we came to with Billy and with Pat, that there was this great expectation. And then there was a sort of reconditioning, if you like, rather than a reconnection, and the Tories took power again and there was the energy crisis and there were all the stories when you could see with Pertwee before the rush again of youth and reclaiming the lost hope, which is Tom. You've had Doctor Who always touching on the political pulse at the time. We're getting that now. Yes, we live in despairing times. Yes, there isn't funding. Yes, pensioners are freezing, all the rest of it. Education is starting to cost. But we can still reclaim the meaning of our lives and create our own subcultures and our own what the ruling class would call deviant, we actually call life and art.
Mm. In terms of art, there is a video game I funded on Kickstarter.
Ah.
This is going somewhere. Called Yooka-Laylee. It's building on an old series of games called Banjo-Kazooie. The original program is it's a British game. And what happened was it was massively funded. It was fully funded within 38 minutes on Kickstarter, £175,000.
Because you have to play it naked. Yes. Ouch, actually, those strings hurt when they snap. Go on.
Ended up with £2.5 million funding. Yeah. Now, a fan of their games, a gamer with a YouTube channel, his handle is JonTron, and pretty much he kind of said, hey, guys, I love your stuff. I've pre-bought the game. You're so wonderful. I would have loved to have been in it. And they're like, well, why don't you play a voice in the game? So they recorded his voice. Da, da, da. About 2 months before release, he went on this massive anti-immigrant rant, kind of pro-Trump, what have you, and then kind of doubled down on it, and they removed him from the game. And the thing is, no one asked them to. But they said, "When you know, we're not comfortable with him representing." And of course, there was a backlash against that. Oh, you know, this is censorship, et cetera, et cetera. But it is kind of an example of you cannot make art that is not political. And who you choose to have involved in that art has a political message to it as well. The Ender's Game movie a couple of years ago, the studio desperately tried to say, oh, you know, it's not about the politics contained within the story. It's not about the politics of the author. And lots of people said, no, actually it is, because it is pushing that idea.
Yeah.
And not critiquing it. You know, you haven't used this as an opportunity to update the story. It's just kind of a straightforward adaptation. And you know what? If people want to put out that kind of art that says morally dubious things, I think it is important that that art is experienced, but it cannot be above question. And so when people, for instance, might look back at the Tom Baker era and say, oh, no, you can't criticize Hinchcliffe. You know, Hinchcliffe was wonderful. Well, we were very critical of Hinchcliffe. And I think it's equally true here that Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy at the time and in the years afterwards came in for a fair bit of a kicking. Mm. And there has been a reappraisal of them, especially in the DVD market and after the new series. But I think we've said this before as well. There never was a golden age of Doctor Who. You know, there are eras
not since Barbara left.
It's like he reached down my throat.
But, you know, objectively, there's no golden age of Doctor Who. Personally, there certainly is. That's the thing. And that's okay. And it's okay to say that. And it's okay for friend of the podcast, Bernard, to make fun of us for saying that Snake Dance is a neglected gem and are we 20 years behind the rest of the world? That's okay, because that's dialogue. That's dialogue about how we experience art and how we experience the world.
Yeah.
And that's really valuable. And the only time you lose that is when you kind of say, oh, no, you're just wrong. Like, Richard, you know, you've said just now that you kind of consider this story to be quite a mess.
Oh, I think it's extraordinary and beautiful, but I don't think it just doesn't gel on screen.
Whereas for me, it gels a lot more.
Mm.
And that's okay. You know, we don't have to agree on these things, but that is also a part of the political and personal experience.
I'm surprised how watchable I found it when as I say, it was one of the sealed tombs of Rassilon copies that I just never unearthed. And, you know, it's been sitting gathering dust.
No, well, I'm fond of this one, and on many levels it doesn't work, but it is the show for the very, very first time in a very, very long time, trying to do something new.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a whole new show, and yet I can see Pat in it.
Mm.
I could even see Pertwee in this one, you know.
Yeah. I honestly just can't imagine Colin in it, and I love Colin.
Or Tom, actually.
Tom would lord it over a bit. Over
Tom
the
would
girls.
Be awful.
No, yeah. I think Pertwee would as well. I think you need someone.
Yeah, but I actually think Pertwee was a bit kinder and more subtle, especially with the ladies.
you know who I think would be the one other Doctor who'd be totally brilliant in this? Billy.
Yeah.
Imagine Billy with
He'd
the cags.
He'd be flirting with them all, the dirty old scrubber. He would.
I'm not a drinking fountain, and I prefer a bottle of gin to any day.
He would be amazing. And it does actually feel a bit, except of course that would have been cataclysmic, because these things were being built at the time and celebrated. They do say that the birth of postmodernism is actually 1972, and it has a date. It's the end of June 1972 when the Grand Pruitt Ego, isn't that a great name, building estate was destroyed, and it's from the Le Corbusier School, and it won awards when it was built only in the early 60s, but it was high rise for housing development for people on pensions and such like, and there were drugs, there was active gang warfare in the buildings, all the rest of it. So that's only, yeah, so that 1972 is the death of modernism, but it, you know, so we've got there in the end. It might have taken us 15 years, but we're there now.
Speaking of Billy, something I didn't mention last week, between season 23 and 24, of course, JNT thought he wasn't coming back. He went off on holiday and came back to two messages. One, you're still producer of Doctor Who, and two, you have to fire Colin Baker.
You have to fire Colin Baker. Yeah, thank you, Jonathan Powell.
Instead of having like 9 months to prepare for the season, he had...
Was it two?
I think two before they had to start briefing directors. Actually, yeah, and possibly two before they had to start filming. But... because John didn't expect to be there and, you know, he was tired of working on the show and he thought he was finally free of it, he called in Sidney Newman for advice.
This is amazing. I'd forgotten all of this. Have you read the letters?
Oh, my God. It's insane. So
Nathan, do you know this story?
No, I've never heard of this.
And Verity was also brought in?
Yeah. Yeah,
or consultant. She said, I've got better things to do with my life. Thank you. Sidney. He's 93 and has no idea where he is. Ask him.
Sidney Newman's ideas included an older doctor again. So
do you
get
know
back
who
to
he
the Billy
he told them to cast?
No, who did he suggest?
He said, you must recast Patrick Troughton.
Oh, yes.
He's still venerable and virile. He still moves about. Yeah, he's still got it.
And then he died.
He died on the job.
Yeah.
He must not know how to control the ship. He must want to go home. And then he must regenerate into a woman person.
Mm.
But not a Wonder Woman, because we've had too many of these strong, strident dynasty ladies. But more on her later. He must have two companions.
Brother and sister.
John and... No, not John and Jim. Go on.
But, okay, yeah, so brother and sister, aged, I think, 17 and 13.
Aged annoyingly.
Yeah. And the sister, who is the younger one, would have her hair in pigtails with John Lennon spectacles. And when she gets upset or stressed, she plays the trumpet.
Oh, dear.
But she's a bit AC, though, in the way he just, or perhaps is a melange again, because the brother was a tagger. The brother sprays graffiti on everything.
You know, he had some modern ideas in there, but
this is not
many.
The young people are into.
Yeah.
I think they just all had an enormous chortle at the BBC and thought, oh, struth, what do we do now?
You know, it's like when they auditioned Sylvester, and we touched on this last week. JNT wanted Sylvester, but of course Sixth Lord, Jonathan Powell, said, no, we must see other actors. And JNT was enraged by this. He's like, you're forcing me to stay on, but you won't trust me. So the way he describes it and the way Syl describes it is, we got two other very good actors, but completely wrong for the part. Now, the thing is, they got in more than two. They got in Ken Campbell.
Who was terrifying. Who started Syl's career in 1970 as part of the Ken Campbell Roadshow. You remember Sylvester McCoy, the human bomb, which is how he started his career. That was the guy that, in fact, you know, Sylvester based a lot of his performances on early on. And Sylvester was still better than Ken.
Yeah.
Is he Roger in that episode of Fawlty Towers?
Yeah, in the anniversary. Yeah.
Yes.
They got in Chris
Can
Jury.
You imagine?
Terrible.
They got in Chris Jury, who later played Deadbeat in Greatest Show in the Galaxy. They got in Dermot Crowley.
Who's actually not bad in the audition tape. It's on one of the...
it's on one of the DVDs.
It's on one of the DVDs for this season, yeah.
And Harry Fielder.
And another bloke who is kind of just really, why?
And so the last two, we have their audition tapes along with Sylvester's. Dermot Crowley would have been interesting.
Acting right up against Janet Fielding.
Yeah. So, and they did...
Brave man.
And they did, I believe, two scenes. So they did the Iron Lady scene, which was extensively reworked for inclusion in the Happiness Patrol.
Yes, and?
And they did what will become Mel's leaving scene in Dragonfire. And Sylv kind of impresses the most in that, and it's where it brings that melancholy we've been talking about.
And it's Cartmell who wrote both of these scenes.
Right. Yeah.
For Janet Fielding, who they actually wanted to play the Doctor right from the start.
That would have been great.
And I have
She's
to say,
actually quite good in these.
In those auditions, she is amazing as Thatcher.
Well, terrifying. Indeed, as Peter Davison would say, just playing herself.
There was a funny moment on Twitter the other day where Janet wished Colin Baker a happy birthday and said, I'm sure you were always reasonable to all your companions. Yes! To which Peter Davison responded, well, I'm sure he had very reasonable companions.
Oh my goodness, there's not an inch of sunlight in all that shade, is there?
They love each other, you can just tell.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of glad they didn't go with Sidney Newman's ideas, mainly because
they were crazy.
There's nothing postmodern about those ideas.
No, it's just like, oh yes, this new show called Doctor Who, which is exactly his thing for that. Yes, with Biddy and Cliff.
You know, when you think back in 1963, if you look at his notes, practically nothing makes it into the show. And he's like, no monsters. We can't have any monsters in Doctor Who. We wouldn't have Nathan on this podcast if there were no monsters. No. We'd have James, who's now going to jump in a time machine and go back to avert the creation of the Daleks.
Harsh but fair. He could do that too.
Just to spite me. He's a vindictive James.
Gentlemen, Kangs, Rezzies, caretakers, we think we all deserve a bit of a holiday, so we're off to Disneyland in 1959.
Hooray!
How can the BBC budget stretch to this? We'll find out next week with Delta and the Bannermen. Do come back for that. Until then, you can find us online at flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FDE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, you can find the Pierce Brosnan era. And that's on bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Don't forget, voting is still open for our Peter Davison commentary. Your choices are Four to Doomsday, nominated by Todd, Ark of Infinity, nominated by me, Enlightenment, nominated by Richard.
That's a good one, listener.
And Resurrection of the Daleks, nominated by Nathan.
He hates that.
Because I hate the world and everyone in it.
It's a Bond film with Pierce Brosnan, isn't it?
Until next week, may you not disappear up a Rezzy's waste disposal chute. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Good night. I'm steaming my tulle skirt for next week as we speak. Cheers.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, logo designed by Anthony Wells. This episode, Thatcher's Britain, was recorded on the 12th of June 2017. The next episode will be released on the 2nd of July. We would like to apologise to our listeners for bringing up any unpleasant memories of the Thatcher years and are delighted to reassure you that nothing like them can ever happen again.
We're releasing some lovely dunkable biscuit varietals the Bonfinger label too. You'll soon be able to purchase for your added enjoyment.
Yes.
It goes with Pierce Brosnan's tea bag.
Roger Monte Carlo's.
Sean Canary things.
Just
dreadful man.
Just trying to think of a biscuit beginning with D, but I can't. George Lamington.
Are you doing the are we voting?
Yeah. Don't forget.